Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Okay, welcome to the Truth to Power Show. I'm your host, VJR Nathan, and this is Radio Free Brooklyn. Today's guests are Neha Gautam and Brandon Herman. They're both filmmakers in Brooklyn. We're going to start the conversation about first of all, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. So we'll start the conversation with the impact of films in your life and think films or stories that have had a big impact on you. So why don't we start with Brandon, either in childhood or in adulthood, films that have really had a big impact on you. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I think Star Wars has been a big influence on me. I just love really big popcorn movies. And if you could imbue that with some kind of real heart and morality and message, then I think that's really exciting. If you could achieve spectacle and still have heart at the same time. So yeah, that's always been added. I mean, I've just loved sci-fi and the kind of the optimism of it, but also the way it kind of cloaks conversations about our current world in metaphor. I find intriguing and amazing.
Yeah, I know that this science fiction actually has a long history of being a social commentary and social progress, pushing forward the envelope, especially in Star Trek.
Sure.
Has had a big influence on social conventions and ways in which we look at multiculturalism and such.
There's an amazing thing I've seen where the people at NASA in the earliest days and developing some of the ships and the communication, all these things, they were influenced by Star Trek from earlier in the 60s. And they had been influenced by earlier space things and other earlier space writings. And then it was kind of a back and forth for several generations of Star Trek inspiring real scientists and motivating kids to becoming scientists. And then those scientists coming up and inventing stuff that influenced the next generation of Star Trek. And so the back and forth of that is fascinating.
Yeah, great. And Neha, would you like to come in with some stories or movies that have influenced you over the years?
Yeah, sure. I'll talk about movies that have had impact on me in my youth. So up until like my early 20s. But I am an immigrant and I used to always be around my grandmother because my grandmother used to babysit me and she used to watch early Indian cinema, like black and white Indian cinema. So I remember, seeing stories, Raj Kapoor, all the greats. And then Meera Nair directed a film called Mississippi Masala, which had a huge impact on me. My family's working class. It was one of the first films which I had seen working class Desis. In their lives in the United States and kind of also struggling with things like internalized racism, colorism, anti-blackness. That film had a huge impact on me and on my identity. And also another film called Slam, starring Saul Williams, which was a beautiful film. A lot of like spoken word in it and, a lot of mix between narrative and documentary form in it as well, but kind of dabbled in looking into mass incarceration and kind of the life of this man that was, going through his case. Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee, classic. I'm living in Brooklyn now, but I grew up in Queens, but, just very influenced by Spike Lee and a bunch of others as well. But those are the ones that come up right now.
Yeah. I mean, I recently saw the movie. Actually, I saw a play, a musical dealing with Afrofuturism. And I interviewed someone else about Afrofuturism and how telling the stories of diverse voices in science fiction is so important and being able to mix it with the cultures and the interculturality of intercultures of different places around the world and not just telling, standardized stories, but even mainstream, major stars starting to get stars that are finally, we're starting to see diverse voices in stars,
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then why don't we talk a little bit about story structure and how that informs your own filmmaking? So, if, Neha, would you like to start? And how you do mostly documentary, I believe. You tell us a little bit about your background. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. I got into media after I finished my undergrad in my mid-20s. I started, I took a photography class, and I, you know, was doing still photography. I was freelancing for a long time. And then I got into moving image, and I was freelancing for mostly nonprofits and foundations that wanted to kind of highlight the work that they were doing, the campaigns and different things. So I got into that. But a lot of the organizations I was working with were in Queens doing immigrant justice work, doing different campaigns. I was friends with someone working with an organization called Damayan, which works with domestic workers, Filipina domestic workers. And there was one woman that I profiled. Her name is Juana, and she had a really interesting story. She was really inspiring. She had a case against her employers who basically it's a form of labor trafficking. She was not paid for her wages, so she had this case, which politicized her, and she's now an organizer and fights for other domestic workers. So I did a profile on her, and I screened that film at the Queens Film Festival
nice.
In 2014. In 2015, I wanted to do something more personal. I am queer, and I'm Desi and an immigrant, and a big part of my healing and my community is creating safe spaces. And I lived in a collective home with about six other queer women of color. And I kind of, you know, it was something that we talked about. But when I told people kind of what we were doing, people were always surprised. So I was like, you know, I think that it would do a lot for young people to show kind of how we do this. So I basically made a documentary about our home that we created, and it was called Chosen Family. I think it also kind of delves into how housing is a huge issue and how we create homes and spaces for ourselves as queer people of color that are safe and that we can thrive in. So those are the two documentaries that I've worked on. I want to get into narrative. I dabble in a lot of different forms, and I love, you know, I have a kind of multimedia disciplinary, but I want to be doing more narratives. I have a lot of stories that I want to tell. You know, nonlinear form is something I want to be able to do. But when I think of a story, I think I want to kind of feel really intimate with who I'm profiling or who I'm getting to know, and kind of understand what they're going through, and also look for visuals that are really dynamic. And it's always a journey, like coming up with a film. It's sometimes it's kind of like writing a thesis or something, where you are doing all this research and then you have something at the end, and then you go back and you kind of relook at, you know, what you were trying to say, and have to kind of look, assess, and see if that's the same thing. And sometimes you have to change it and be open to that process.
Good, good. And I understand, Brandon, you have a studio, Search and Rescue, that ended up becoming a safe haven. You know, if you talk a little bit about that, yeah.
Yeah, what you're saying is really interesting to me. My assistant is an LGBT producer. She produces all these LGBT events. One's called Kalalolo, that she just did a show at Coney Island that was incredible. But she comes from a commune background, and she left her parents' house very early and was living there, and met a lot of other people. And kind of where we are, which is on the North Shore of Staten Island right now, there is a scene that didn't have a place. So a year ago, just over a year ago, I took studio space that was meant to be a place for me to work, do film and video work, some photography work. But the way we're set up, we can have public events, and we could have bands come in, we could have poetry readings and things like that. And largely she curates those. And so she's done her Kalalolo show, which she describes as a queer variety show with singers and dancers and burlesquers and clowns and drag and everything that you can imagine. Really, really powerful, important stuff. And we've had other groups come in and like I said, do poetry readings, do CD release parties there. So the studio So the production company is called Search and Rescue Productions, and the studio is Search Party Studio. And if people are interested in doing stuff there, that's certainly something that I love to talk to people about. We like having stuff come in. We like having art projects go up there. We're talking to one of the local arts groups now about doing a monthly screening series. And again, it's just there are so few venues in our neighborhood to just be able to go beyond just my own work, which, you know, takes place ostensibly Monday through Friday. Sometimes we have shoots on the weekend. But to also open it up and say a few times a month we could have performers come in. And then, just in the work that we're doing, you know, it's just a matter of trying to be inclusive and diverse and empathetic to other people.
Good, good. That's really great. I feel a sense of empathy is driving both of you. But to go a little bit more about what the compelling visions that drive you is, what really gets you as a moral compass, you know, what your moral compass is to help you navigate whether it be in your art or in your personal life, and what values drive you as a person. So, Brandon, you want to start?
Oh, God. I think it's just that as simple as having empathy for other people. And what's the Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm, right? Just don't harm other people.
Yeah.
And maybe it's naive to boil it down so simply, but I think, you know, if you go back to that, and you just go back to that concept of kindness and love. And, you know, you could wrap it up in robots and helicopters and all these explosions. And you could tell a fun story that doesn't have to hit people over the head with a conversation about let's be nice to everybody.
Yeah.
You could tell a story where you have your bad guys in your story doing bad things. And you're supposed to know as an audience they're doing that. They're the bad guys. Yeah. And you have your heroes and you design what your heroes are and how well they care for their friends and what they prioritize. So, you know, whether you're looking at the New Testament or you're looking at Harry Potter, it's like here's a character, here's somebody who presents a strong moral viewpoint, who cares for their friends, who cares about freedom, who is fighting evil, and even when it brings harm to them, they need to stand up and fight evil.
Good, good. Sneha?
I think for me, my background is a community organizer, and I got politicized as an activist while I was in college. So social justice and just thinking of the fight for marginalized and oppressed peoples is kind of the background of everything I do. I'm always thinking of, you know, it's also the personal's political. So a lot of the stories that I'm interested in are stories that I can relate to. Like I said, I'm an immigrant. I'm queer. I'm a woman of color. So, you know, I'm always focused on, even if when I'm working on a project, like who am I hiring, who am I working with, not just the stories I'm telling, but I'm also, you know, thinking of representation as a form of power, you know, what stories I want to highlight. And, you know, many times I watch films and I'm always giving my own Bechdel test just, you know, want to see more dynamic characters and people that reflect real, you know, characters that people I saw growing up, like my mother, like my family, like, you know, my mentors. But I, you know, I do want to do something with the media that I'm making as well, whether it be empower someone or, you know, tell a story that is not represented in mainstream media.
So important when you bring up personal as political. That's one of the major themes of the show, and how, you know, we talked a little bit about how, you know, the experiences we have in a personal level, the kind of things that we think about are very relative to us, are actually reflective in the society at large. And, you know, if we could talk a little bit about if everything were ideal, if this were utopia, you know, if this was kind of your vision of what the world would be like if it was perfect, what would it look like and how would you feel? So, Neha, would you like to start with that? Yeah.
My utopia.
Yeah.
For my undergrad, I studied history and international affairs. You know, I believe in human rights. I believe that everybody should have access to health, you know, drinking water, food, shelter, and safety and housing, healthcare, et cetera. I think that, you know, we definitely have enough resources and wealth and capital in this country to produce that. It is a man-made you know, poverty is man-made, and you know, I think that everyone deserves a certain level of dignity and respect, no matter who you are, and those are things that I live by. So I would want a world that encompasses that. And you know, some people call it socialist. I think it's not really socialist. It's just taking care of your people as citizens. You know, but yeah, I think that's the world that I want to see. Of course, I want to see a world where, you know, women have the same rights to do the things and to, you know, have access to things and be represented in their careers and choices and safety and the ability to move. I think I also, as an immigrant, I'm thinking of borders a lot. And I think that a lot of people move, you know, migrate because they don't have a choice. And because it's forced migration because of the conditions that are, you know, put against them in where they are. So, you know, thinking of my family's story, I didn't have a choice to come here, but, you know, thinking of what pushed them to come here. And I think that trauma, migration is trauma for a lot of people. So minimizing trauma, intergenerational trauma, is something that I am working on. I'm an educator. I work, I've been an educator for 12 years, but I teach film now. And, you know, working with youth, I see a lot of intergenerational trauma as well. And I know that, you know, media for me is not the end. It's a medium to do something. So I'm trying to use that in the work that I'm doing.
Yeah, good, good. Thank you. Thank you. So, Brandon, I feel like talk a little bit about also, you know, ideal world, utopias, and, you know, when you talk a little bit about evil and such and what's wrong with society or misguided about society.
Yeah, first, I want to agree with everything you just said, dead on. I don't mind calling it socialism, but sure. But the only thing I would add to it on top of it is people seem so afraid. And like every month I see an article, robots are taking our jobs, AI is taking our jobs. Mm. Let them take it.
Yeah,
we are meant for grander things than these 9-to-5 physical labor jobs.
Yeah,
we need to fight for universal basic income. We need to fight to replace all of these boring jobs with robotics and automated systems and all that stuff. And we need, as humans, to live as explorers and inventors and artists and go out and explore the universe and go out and create brand new works of our experience and not punch a clock.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the Star Trek universe, they don't even have money. They have like some kind of money. I believe they have some kind of barter, or I don't even know exactly what the system is, but it's a very different system.
And more than anything, they do it for prestige. They do it because they're curious souls. They're on the Enterprise not so they could earn a paycheck, not because the society is set up in a way that if they don't have a job, they're left to starve.
Yeah.
They're doing it because they know that that's what we're meant to do. They have a curiosity of knowledge and they want to go out there and explore. And they know that, okay, there's a boss. They have a boss that they report to, somebody who has more experience than them, and they'll work their way up. But it's not a rat race quest for money, which is just kind of a proxy for food or in a house, which should be taken care of. We have the resources. We do not have a truly scarce society. We don't. We have near infinite resources.
Yeah.
And if we just could distribute it in a way that everybody has the basic stuff taken care of, and we put the manual labor portion of that onto robotics and artificial intelligence and all these other things. You know, you look at what, you know, you'll hear people complain of why socialism didn't work in 1950s Russia or something like that. Yeah. Well, that's not the world we are in 2018, where I've got Siri in my pocket and there are, you know, robots on assembly lines and things like that. We are within a few years of being able to hand all of that over if we have the will to do it.
Yeah. And then also, as far as like the visions of our own personal identities and how we've created, you talked a little bit about this, about how, you know, we want to view ourselves as like creating visionaries and artists and such, not to get like kind of bogged down. Would you clarify that?
Yeah. My wife and I would joke that, not to be a spoiler, but at the end of the movie WALL-E.
Yeah.
And if you haven't listened,
yeah,
earmuffs for the next 30 seconds. At the end of WALL-E, there are these humans that are like floating in these chairs in a spaceship, doing no work, just feeding themselves.
Yeah.
If that's what you want, knock yourself out.
Yeah.
I'm not going to take it from you. But I think that we're meant for grander things. And I think that when we have all the work taken away from us, I think people are going to have a quest not for fulfillment from work, which is something you'll hear a lot.
Yeah.
Like people need the fulfillment of working for someone else and helping someone else make a fortune. Uh-huh. They'll have they'll need a fulfillment of new discoveries or new creation, new art.
Yeah. I think it's important to recognize that. And now if you talk a bit about kind of about your identity and how, you know, in response, a lot of times, like we get trapped in response to some other, system, but rather creating the identity, you know, as individual and as a artist, mm-hmm. and how, and what's kind of influenced that. Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit about that, but just continue. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how to say this sounding hokey, but I think that when I allowed myself to call myself an artist, I realized that it was part of a spiritual journey.
Yeah.
In that I was creating art to heal and to heal other people. I can't talk about, also, I forgot to mention this earlier, I can't talk about the world I want to see without talking about Earth democracy and the commons and, you know, liberation for not just humans, but living things and the elements. And I think that, you know, part of what is going on is that a lot of us are, as a history major, I've also looked a lot at the last 100 years and how much our lives have changed in terms of how we consume food, things like that. Like, yeah, we have, an enormous amount of technology. But when I look at my lineage, I know that my ancestors were growing their food. They were working in agriculture. Most of this world worked in agriculture 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, I have been very intentional in kind of getting connected to that history and those roots. Like, I've been doing a lot of urban farming and talking about earth justice and things like that. But I think that a lot of young people have been kind of removed from that legacy that our ancestors have had. And I think it provides a lot for us. So I know that informs a lot of what I do as well. And, you know, being in a country where I don't have land, like this is not my land. I don't own anything. But, you know, at the same time, if I were to go to India, I don't have land there either. There's not something that I can call mine. But, you know, putting my hands in the soil or, being a part of something lets me see that I'm also connected to everything going on and the well-being of the environment. And so I want to care about that as well. And yeah.
Yeah, I definitely identify with that, being of two worlds as well, being South Asian and having, you know, going to Indian communities and then having them kind of feel like, or even going to India and feeling like, oh, you're American or you're like from there, and then being in America and feeling like a little strange about that. So I definitely identified that. And also to pull up the thread about the vegetarianism and agriculture and about providing for the world. I know Brandon has a passion for vegetarianism, I believe, or veganism, or what is your...
Yeah,
you talked a little bit about that in your...
Yeah, I've been a vegetarian for about 28 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And about a year ago, after kind of slowly heading that way, became vegan, strictly vegan. And we were talking about it because it was this idea of personal being political. It's, you know, when you removing from the conversation, because it's so polarizing, removing from the conversation the rights of animals and that we're torturing and murdering millions upon millions and millions of animals. Let's table it. Okay. You know, if you don't care already, I'm not going to convince you right now. So let's table it for a second. Being vegan reduces the methane, it reduces the runoff into the water supply. It has ripples that help and benefit society.
Mm.
It would, if on a larger scale, as it continues to grow at the moment, it would free up acres and acres and acres of land right now being used for all of this. So that idea that the things that you do are actively either benefiting society as a whole or they're harming society as a whole, and you have to make that decision. And that's separate from, you know, a question of animal rights or something like that.
Good. So now, to talk a little bit about how we enter dialogue with people, you kind of started to begin on that. You're in dialogue as an artist, you're putting stuff out there, you're getting in dialogue with in the community, with the other filmmakers, and how, you know, each of you has a specific vision for what you'd like to see in the world. And how do you find that dialogue enhances or changes your vision or tries to, you know, shape it? So the dialogue with other filmmakers, the dialogue with collaborations and such. So now you want to take that or you want to start off with that? You get something when you're making that? Because you do a lot of documentary stuff where you're dealing directly with the...
I think it's in terms of collaboration, it's like, you meet people all the time. I'm constantly talking to everyone that I come across. And I find stories really interesting. I find people really interesting. So I gravitate towards people that have stories that I want to know more about, that I'm curious about. There's always a story that I want to know more about. And could just go on learning more about. And I think that process is really interesting. I work with youth. And so I teach film to middle school and high school youth. And a lot of times they're my inspiration. They are going through a lot of really real things. Their lives are, falling apart. They're going through divorce, trauma. Some of them have been in foster care. They've been through the system. They have very complex, stories and kind of assessments of who they are and what they're going through. It's kind of the people that I come across every day, and I just, have a conversation with them. And if they're open to it, I usually see if they're open to continuing the dialogue.
Yeah. And how is do you find your preconceptions before entering the dialogue? Have they changed, or in what way? Can you tell us a specific example of how maybe you came into a story or came into a dialogue with someone who you thought, they'd be such and such, or they'd be X, Y, and Z, or the story would be about X, Y, and Z, and then how they changed that vision? Mm-hmm. Or they were able to bring you a new perspective or new inlet? Yeah.
Well, I think as an educator, I work for Brick Arts Media, and I am, a lot of times working with young people, and they're making their first films, and I'm helping them with that process. And, I think a lot of times I just think that, they don't have a lot going on, or they're just consumed by video games or their cell phones or popular culture. But I had this one student who wanted to do a documentary about her own life, and she had been in foster care since she was young. And she told me, I asked the students, I gave them a bunch of prompts, and one of the prompts was that they could talk about a challenge that they overcame that kind of informed them and how they live now. And she said that she was kind of thinking about how she could become independent, because at the age of 21, she would no longer be of the state's responsibility. So, as a youth, I was just kind of baffled by how she was kind of taking this in and dealing with it in her everyday. But she was also making a film about it and talking about it. And so, ready to share that story. And I think people are always looking at young people, at youth, and thinking that they don't have a lot going on, but they have complex ideas about, institutions, about institutionalized racism, things like that. And I think I have to check myself sometimes and just see them as people and not just, children or people that don't have things to say or have not been through struggles of their own.
Yeah, it's amazing how the kids that I teach or the kids I encounter at the library, they have so much, such a rich experiences, and sometimes struggles that inform them as a person and that give them a new perspective, and they have many lessons that I can learn from, So Brandon, what about when you're telling a story or when you're reading a story, we'll focus on craft, on craft when you're creating a story.
Yeah.
That what kind of discoveries you make or even just in your personal life. Yeah.
I'll tell a story. I did a music video recently for an artist And the artist's name is Snail Mail. She's 18 or 19 years old. She got signed by a record label called Matador right out of high school. And the brief was sent out to a couple different directors saying, we want to make a video for this song. And it's called Heat Wave. And she wants to be playing ice hockey in it. She played ice hockey as a kid from the time she was 8 to the time she was 16. And she wants to be playing hockey in the video. That was it. And each director had to fill out a pitch, you know, design, like, okay, well, what's my take on that going to be? So to prepare for that, I wound up watching 3 or 4 of her performances, some of which are these kind of sessions where she's being interviewed between songs. And I read a whole bunch of articles about her where she talks about being a queer artist, where she talks about being on the hockey team and the boys that she played with just being jerks. And now they're all these alt-right Trump supporter guys. And so when I did all that research, when I sat down, the pitch that I wound up submitting was that she walks into this bar or restaurant on a hot summer day. There's an air hockey table there. She starts playing air hockey through the miracle of music video nonsensicalisms. She's in the air hockey game. She's on a hockey rink now. And it looks like Tron. If you look at it, you know, this brief got picked and we actually made this video. And it looks like Tron. We lowered all the lights in this hockey rink that we've got. We put all these blue glow lights everywhere and around the goal. And the story of it, the narrative, is that she's alone and these four skaters, these four guys, start to encroach on her and start to kind of bully her. And at first she tries to flee them, but they chase her and slam her into the wall. And then when she kind of regains herself, she's able to come back and conquer them, and she's able to literally skate circles around them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there was this thing where, like, it came out of this perspective that, I mean, you can see on the radio, but I'm a 42-year-old white guy. It's not an experience that I've had, but it came out of this experience that I learned about this young girl and what she goes through, and that, you know, became something that, if you look at the comments on the video, where people are having kind of, you know, visceral reactions to some of that, or really kind of understanding where a lot of that comes from.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good to be able to open ourselves up to different perspectives, open ourselves up in our storytelling, different perspectives, and understand that empathy. The empathy is so important. I think we discussed a little bit about that, the empathy, and how it's so easy to get lost in our own experiences and amplifying those experiences, but then ultimately coming to a place where we understand that, you know, that we all are human beings ultimately, and that we all have a wish for, you know, happiness, that we all have a desire to overcome suffering, and that, you know, yeah. So now you want to talk a little bit about kind of anything coming up for you as far as like the different ways in which we can approach empathy. We can kind of like maybe something about empathy or something about, like, you know, the purpose ultimately, I guess, is to kind of create in your viewer something, and whether or not with these kinds of films, you want them also to take action and do something and be active in the world and go out there and make.
I've been doing film and video. I've been freelancing for about 5 years. Like I said, I have a photography background, but I am starting an MFA program next month at Brooklyn College, the Steiner Studios, the Fierstein program. It's a small program. There's not a lot of women of color. I'm excited to be in the program. I'm excited to have resources and equipment and, you know, gain access to things and tell more stories. I think I'm excited to, you know, I'm also going to be writing, which is something that I don't have a lot of background in, but, you know, I have a lot of stories, but, like I said earlier, you know, Mississippi Masala had a huge impact on me. There's a lot of artists, comedians, you know, Hari Kondombolu, you know, that I've been kind of watching and, you know, that have been talking about the way we've looked at South Asian characters, needs to kind of be assessed and the impact that it has on popular culture. But, you know, growing up, my family, my father drove a taxi for like 25 years. My grandfather as well. My uncles still do. They drive livery cab in Alaska and in Seattle. And one thing that I've been wanting to do is a story about that drivers and kind of, I know there's just like, I've been late, just recently I left something. I only take yellow cabs, green cabs, livery cabs, specifically because of, you know, that history of being raised by working class taxi drivers and just knowing that struggle with the medallion. And so, yeah, I think it, you know, I grew up working class and an immigrant, and I don't see the South Asians that I do see on TV are very, you know, they're very one dimensional. They're doctors and lawyers and kind of like this one kind of sided character. But I like to see more people like me. And I think I, you know, the youth that I worked with for an organization called South Asian Youth Action for many years. And they see communities in and around Queens that I've been working with. Now I kind of work more with Nepali youth. But I would love to do something that that brings in like oral history and something where it's a collective process of kind of documenting an experience and then using that to create a script.
Yeah.
That would kind of highlight something.
I know Quantico came out a couple years ago or something, and that was one of the few times I saw a South Asian woman in a lead that seemed like, when I saw it, I saw just a few episodes, but it seemed like she had a pretty, you know, rounded character. Mm-hmm. But it's like a rare thing to see right. South Asian character portrayed in a way that's very complex. You know, most right. time, as you're saying, they're very like one-dimensional, very like following stereotypes and right. such. And I recently saw The Problem with the Pooh finally. Mm-hmm. You know, I finally understood a little bit better about, you know, some of the dialogue around that character. And of course, growing up, I know, you know, having, you know, lived with, you know, kind of very few South Asian representations and such mm-hmm. on media. I was originally interested in going into theater and media. And then because part of the reason or one of the reasons why I'd end up not pursuing is because there was not enough kind of groundbreaking of mm-hmm. South Asian. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times in casting and such, they'd be like, oh, well, you know, the tendency is that the character is white. The character is you know, they have the very specific, you know, vision for the character. And, you know, it's very rare to get breakthrough, you know. Mm-hmm. But as far as representation in cinema goes, any comments about kind of how you're able to kind of look towards that, either things you consume or we can talk about like things you consume or things you're working on and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, here's what I'll mention. There's something that we talked about a little bit earlier, but there's this outroar from this very small corner of the internet
yeah.
about too much diversity.
Yeah.
And whether it's Marvel or Wonder Woman or in Star Wars, in the newer Star Wars films, there's woman front and center. There's a black stormtrooper front and center.
Yeah.
And first of all, if you're real fans of those properties,
yeah,
you don't have a problem with it because yeah. built into those properties is a sense of inclusion, a sense of justice, a sense of freedom, all those things. If you're upset, then you misunderstood everything yeah. up till now. So I think that's good. But let's, you know, the three of us here know how important representation is. We know how important diversity on screen is. But let's for a second put the issue of that aside and say, wasn't Black Panther just amazing separate from that?
Yeah.
Wasn't it just a vision that we had never seen before? And isn't the originality of that, even if you don't care about diversity at all, isn't the fact that we're getting new stories
yeah.
worthwhile in itself? Mm-hmm. Where's the problem?
Exactly. I think it's unfortunate that there's so much focus placed on that minority of people.
Yeah.
And they're being amplified and they're being, you know, put into the spot. And then that's influencing decision making
yeah.
of the studios and such. And it's unfortunate that there's such an amplification of that on the internet has given a, you know, I talked a little bit about someone about hive mind and how the hive mind of the internet, hive mind of these specific forums like Facebook or Twitter, especially Twitter. I think Twitter and YouTube, the comments on YouTube tend to become very like yeah. vitriol.
Mm.
Facebook, I find, tends not to be as bad, although, you know, the general communities, sometimes people are willing to put their stuff out there, you know, and be very kind of, but I know like many stars have withdrawn from Instagram
yeah.
because of that. And it's so unfortunate that these people have so much power now and that the hate and the anxiety and the is causing anxiety, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what can we do really to combat that and how do you think that we can create a counter movement, if you will? I mean, you know, trying to slowly, you know, put our voices out there and, mm-hmm. you know, and slowly move the conversation towards these things if anyone wants to jump in. Yeah.
Well, I like the idea of calling it a counter movement because, you know, I think generally it's a waste of time to argue. Not that it's a waste of time to do something, but it's a waste of time to argue with people like that and try to use reason and facts because they do not care about reason and facts. So you're wasting your time to argue with them, but you can take that same time and use it to put something positive out, to put something that does espouse your own beliefs out there and try to get that into the world. And, you know, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. There are more of us. It's just a matter of getting us out to the polls. If you have an hour, rather than doing research and putting a response to a comment on Facebook for somebody in a red state where their vote isn't gonna change the needle at all anyway, you could take that hour and try to help some local organization. You could get involved in your local politics. You could use that hour to just, you know, write a play that talks about this issue, and now you're creating art and putting that into the world. That's, I think, a better use of time. But I like the idea of considering it a counter movement to that rather than trying to face it head on. Just forget them.
Yeah.
You know,
they'll die out. You were telling a story about how, if you tell the story about your coach or a high school coach.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, tell a little bit about it, because I think that really speaks to how our craftsmanship and the importance of craftsmanship.
Yeah. Well, I was telling Vijay the story when I was in high school one day. We were in our English class. And we were all complaining because it was raining out. It was like our last class of the day. And we were going to have to go home, and it was raining out. We were all just kind of grousing about it. And my English teacher said, you know what? When I was in high school, I loved when it rained because I ran track. And I would get home and run home, and I'd put my sneakers on, and I'd go out for my run, same as I did when it was dry out. And I knew no one else did that. I knew none of the other people and the other teams who I was competing with would do that. And it gave me an advantage to go out and do it because it scared away everybody else. And that always stuck with me. And several years later, I ran into that teacher somewhere in an event, and I told him that story that I think about it all the time. And he was like, yeah. It had no effect on him whatsoever, but I carry that story with me 25 years later.
Yeah, thinking about how we can constantly hone ourselves, and we need to be prepared to maybe go into battle almost.
Not be scared away by things that aren't really all that scary. It's easy to get startled, and it's easy to get dissuaded, and if you can push through, you have an advantage over everyone else that it called out.
Yeah, I definitely think honing our crafts and continuing to develop and such and you know, speaking for those voices, amplifying our own voices. So if you want to talk about a little bit about how, you know, some lessons you've learned and maybe any experiences you've had that can tell a story about how you've, what drives you again, returning to what drives you as we close up, you know, like what drives you and what kind of has taught you an important lesson. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I love art. I love filmmaking. I do have a hard time speaking though, because I'm always on the other side of the camera. I'm not in front of it, and so I'm learning to be more comfortable. It's partly why I'm here right now. You know, I'm trying to get easier. I'm trying to have be better at this and have it be easier if I do it more. I think also, you know, just thinking about how I was raised by a pretty conservative, family that kind of instilled that I should kind of just sit there and be quiet. And, you know, I have an opinion, but, you know, don't be too loud. Don't take up too much space. So I'm always checking that. I'm always, kind of trying to empower myself by using my voice. And then in the process, hoping that it does something for others. Whether it be sharing a story, but I think it's really important for our own liberation as well. Just also as a woman, when I was an organizer, this girl was explaining to me that, you know, when you look around a room and in the class, you usually look at who is, you know, more comfortable speaking, and that usually is sometimes political, you know, who feels like that they have the right to speak, So I'm constantly, you know, checking that. One of my guidelines when I was an organizer was step up, step back. And I, you know, I say that to young people, if you're not comfortable, if you usually don't speak, you know, try to speak. But if you usually take up too much space, then maybe you need to step back.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that people are not aware of that. But just those kind of, you know, dynamics in everyday spaces is hard to check and something I'm becoming more aware of. So, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think patterns in ourselves and inside are important to recognize and understand. I know, speaking as a male, you know, sometimes I always remember in my classes in college, there was always a gender inequality. There was always a feeling that, you know, the men were speaking out a lot and the mm-hmm. women were not speaking out enough. And I definitely learned that lesson. I definitely tried to internalize that lesson of, you know I speak a lot, so I definitely want to try to platform other people and platform women, platform everyone who give them a chance to speak. And, you know, I think it's so important for our audiences as well to listen and internalize that, understand patterns in themselves and society as a whole.
Yeah.
So, why don't we talk a little bit about, as we close up, just about what's coming up for you as far as like, you know, the future and what you're looking towards, what you're planning towards. We talked a little bit about this. Now I was talking a little bit about going into storytelling and going into narrative driven films. So if you want to talk a little bit more about that, or if you want to, whatever you want, a little bit more about kind of like what your vision for yourself, even more broadly, in the coming years.
Yeah. So I'm, like I mentioned earlier, I'm starting an MFA program. This is my second time in grad school. So it's kind of a big deal also because as a working class immigrant, you know, art is usually kind of looked down on and it's not taken seriously as a career or something that you can, you know, pay your bills with. And so it took a long time to get here. You know, I'm in my mid-30s, and that's kind of a big deal for me. So I'm excited about this journey, but I'm also excited to you know, write some scripts and to create some films. I'll have access to resources. I have a small scholarship, but I also have access to funds to create a film. And I, you know, I have a huge community of organizers and activists and healers and folks in New York that I want to work with, that I want to bring along with me on this journey. And, you know, I'm open to see where it goes. I have to create a few films in school, but I'm hoping that this opens the door for other things. And, you know, definitely want to do a feature film eventually, but it's just that I haven't had access to the kinds of funds. And, you know, so I'm excited for that process. You know, I still freelance. A lot of the work that I do for organizations is kind of highlighting the work that they do. But I'm very inspired also by the work that a lot of these organizations are doing. You know, immigration justice, birth justice, reproductive justice movements. There's a bunch of foundations that I've worked with that are, you know, really kind of using the urgency of this time to highlight and get people on board with some really radical, dope work. So, I'm just continuing along that path.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of, I applied for the Queens Arts Council grant.
Awesome.
Which got me a New Works grant I'm just going to be this fall. I'm going to be releasing finally the work done for that grant, Celebrity Sadhana or How to Meditate with the Hammer. So I did some poetry and meditate. It's I'm calling it now a subtitle. The series title is called The Paparazzo Poet Meditations, because it deals a lot with celebrity stuff and and about meditations on like how fame on fame and how, you know, these people in the spotlight are people and how they kind of deal with problems and the way we publicize their scandals. The way we kind of get them in this glass case and look at their human element of scandals. So there's some talk about Winona Ryder kleptomania. You know, so there's some, you know, meditations on that, and meditations on how I identify with these kinds of vulnerabilities and such.
Yeah.
So you guys can, the audience can go look at my website, vjrnathan.com, to keep informed with, you know, the publication when it comes out. And also, awesome. Brandon, if I want to give you a chance to also talk a little bit about what's coming up for you and in the future and what's what you're looking towards.
Yeah, it's something I'm kind of struggling with right now because this has been a wild year. We've done a bunch of music videos. We have some corporate clients that have kind of come and went and hopefully come back. Some things are cyclical. And we get, you know, where I get so caught up in that, that finding time for my own projects has been hard. I just started taking a writing class with these two great young comedians, and it's about writing characters. And it's not at all kind of what my end goal wants to be, but I wanted a deadline and I wanted something that I could do that would be short each week just to kind of force me to do it. I would like to also get to a point where I could get to a narrative feature, and kind of maybe that's 2 years away from me, because I'd want to. I'm kicking around a few ideas. I'm kind of overwhelmed with ideas, but not really sure how to focus on any one of them. Does that sound familiar to you too?
Yeah. I go through the same thing as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, do I write that thing? Do I try to write that TV thing that maybe I could sell somewhere? I definitely can't produce it because it involves a plane. Do I make a low budget horror feature and just to get it done? You know, it's like so many things pulling me in so many different directions. And just trying to figure it out and trying to get focused. And then there's the studio space, and we're doing events there, and we want to be doing more shoots in there. So just figuring out. Oh, one thing I just started doing when we moved into our studio, the first week, we needed some little posters and signs labeling different parts of it. And while I was sitting in front of Photoshop, I made up this one thing. And I made a poster of it, and I put it in the window, and my assistant came in the next day, and she's like, wow, where's that from? And I said, oh, I just made it and had it printed. And she's like, you should make t-shirts of that. And we just started making t-shirts. So I brought you a t-shirt, Jay.
Thank you so much.
And we're going to go big soon. You can see it reads, art is a weapon against ignorance and apathy.
Oh, thank you. Awesome. Thank you. That's awesome. Thank you so much.
But yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I believe it strongly. And so how do we do that? How do we create powerful art that can influence people?
Ask me a little bit from, just to let guys know about the audience know about Radio Free Brooklyn. So do you know that Radio Free Brooklyn has a free iPhone and Android app? So you no longer have to be chained to your computer to listen to this program. You can download the app for Google Play or for iPhone at radiofreebrooklyn.org/iPhone. And also the iPhone app actually just got updated. So I believe that you can access the catalog of back episodes to Truth to Power Show, which is available at truthtopowershow.podomatic.com, and also on iTunes and all these. I believe it's on Spotify as well. I just added it to Spotify.
That's awesome.
So we have like about 30, this is episode 33, I believe, or 32. So it's like about 30 episodes up there. So I hope everyone will go listen. Radio Free Brooklyn is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a free and open platform to our community and promote media literacy, education, and free expression. We rely primarily on donations from listeners like you. So if you'd like to support our mission so we can continue to bring you quality community radio, we invite you to make a one-time donation or monthly pledge to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. You can donate as little as a dollar, and every cent helps us continue to stay on air. So please help support independent community media by pledging whatever you can afford. And remember that RFB is a 501c3 nonprofit, so your contribution is tax deductible to the full extent of the law. And also, finally, Radio Free Brooklyn has a newsletter. So if you want to find out about new programs, upcoming RFB events, interviews, ticket giveaways, etc., go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/newsletter. So also, just to let people know, they can follow me on Twitter, Truth to Power Show, and Facebook VGR Nathan Poet. And if you'd like to be a guest on Radio Free Brooklyn, please feel free to write to me at truthtopowershow@gmail.com. So thanks so much, guys. Thank you.
Thank you for having us,
Vijay. This is so awesome that
thanks
you
for
do
creating this.
This
space.
Yeah,
thank
very
you.
Cool.
To drop on.